Welcome to the Climate Diplomacy Podcast, a podcast from Adelphi, bringing you the latest insights and debates in international climate diplomacy. We are your hosts, Raquel Monayat and Hannah Kuonut. In this series, you will hear from leading experts offering their take on what needs to be done to promote climate foreign policy and provide you with the context you need to understand climate diplomacy today. For more information, please visit climate-diplomacy.org or follow us on Twitter under Climate Diplo.
In this episode, we will speak about climate fragility risks in Mali together with Chitra Nagarayan, author of the Climate Fragility Risk Brief on Mali. She is an independent researcher and member of the Climate Security Expert Network. In her work, Chitra focuses on civilian protection, climate change, conflict analysis and sensitivity, gender and social inclusion, peace building and human rights, particularly those of women and girls. She has worked across West Africa for over a decade. Before we start, we would like to apologize for any small audio disruptions due to remote recording. So welcome, Chitra. It's a great pleasure having you as our guest today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be with you both.
Before we get into the issue of the day, let's talk a little about Mali. What would you say our listeners should know about Mali? Are there important socioeconomic, geographic, or even historic aspects that are crucial to understand the country today?
Well, that's a very big question, but perhaps I'll focus on just two aspects. The first is the conflict context. And while attention tends to be focused on the conflicts in the north of the country, historically and then more recently in the center, it's important to remember or to realize that the majority of Mali's regions are unfortunately affected by conflict and violence to different extents, but still conflict affected. And so in addition to the conflicts that we all know about in the north and center of Mali, we see in the south of Mali also worrying levels of tension, which sometimes flare into violence. And there's a real need for proactive conflict mitigation and peace building in that region. And then the second thing I think it's important to know when we talk about climate security in the country is really the extent to which the climate varies across the country. So it's one country, but has very different experiences when it comes to climate, from the arid Sahara Desert in the north to the Sahel, which is semi-arid, and then the Niger Delta in the center, which is flooded on a seasonal basis, and then finally the savannas in the south. This really impacts the climate experience in the country. So for example, in the north, whereas the rainy season tends to be about 3 months long, in the south, this can last for up to 6 months. You obviously see different temperature variation, more so in the north than in the south, where rather you see increased rainfall. And I'm saying all of this because there's a tendency to think of the Sahel, which is multiple countries, as one climate region. But just by this description, you can see not only that there's a lot of variance when it comes to the different countries that make up the Sahel, but even in one country, there's a lot of climate variability. And there's a real need for more up-to-date, country-specific, sub-national climate data on Mali.
Really interesting. What about politics and security in Mali and also in the broader Sahel region? Specifically, who are the different actors on the ground?
Yeah, I mean, so I'll talk about the conflict actors here. So we have the different organized armed opposition groups. So the jihadists, and there are a number of different groups there, but then also the Tuareg resistance fighters that make up the MNLA. You also have community militia groups, particularly in the center of the country, connected with different communities, which were set up or increased their work in response to increasing insecurity and violence to defend their communities. And then, of course, you have the state, so the state security forces, but then also the UN peacekeepers who work closely with the state, and then a history of foreign forces as well, such as the French in Operation Serval. So there's a number of different conflict armed actors in the country.
And would you say that the potential for conflict and causes of violence are the same across Mali, or are there big differences within the different parts of the country?
So I would say that there are some causes of violence, causes of conflict that are similar across the country. So when we talk about social exclusion, gender inequality, the gap between citizens and the state, unhappiness with corruption, inequality, grievances with predatory state systems and rent-seeking behavior. While that differs according to different parts of the country, there's a commonality in all of that across the nation. However, you also see quite big differences in the different parts of the country. So, for example, in the north, you've seen long-standing Tuareg resistance, first against the French colonizers and then the Malian state, but then also a severe drought that damaged livelihoods and highlighted economic and political marginalization of the north. Arms proliferation as a result of the Libyan civil war, also the return of jihadists and fighters from Libya from the after the 1990s Algerian civil war. Whereas in the center, I mean, there was a long history of contestation within and between communities. But then, in general, conflicts over natural resources tended to be resolved non-violently. Of course, there was outbreaks of violence on a sporadic basis. But what we saw was, in the aftermath of the conflict in the north, increased levels of banditry, cattle theft, and availability of arms, and the regrouping and emergence of armed opposition groups with jihadist ideologies, which really concentrated recruitment on communities that felt particularly aggrieved and marginalized. And so this, you see how that interacted with those earlier histories of contestation to fuel intercommunal tensions. And at the same time, we had particular gender norms around what it means to be a man. We had intergenerational conflict. So with older people seen to be hoarding power and wealth and younger people barred from accessing that in a context where, you know, to be seen as an adult, to be seen as a man, you need to be able to support yourself and your family financially. You need to be able to get married. And so you can see how then this led to increased levels of tensions within communities, but also between communities. And then, of course, that led to the formation of these self-defense groups, which then inflamed matters worse, and it spiraled from there. And so that's the north and the center. Now, in the south, we have yet another situation. So at the moment, the South is relatively stable, but there is a risk that we'll see the underlying drivers of violence in other parts of the country that are also present in southern Mali lead to conflict and lead to a deepening of the existing conflict dynamics that are already present. So, for example, in Sikasso, we already see land conflicts due to land speculation, land grabbing, which leads to grievances over the actions of the economic elite. We see the way that land and control of land is in the hands of men, usually male elders of the family, excluding women, young people, migrant populations, and others marginalized. And we've also seen increasing amounts of migration, like a more permanent and southern migration trend, which intensifies conflict dynamics, specifically between communities that have settled in the region for generations and those who are more newly arrived.
Thanks a lot, Chitra. I think this gives a good basis for us to move on to the main issue that we are addressing today. How is climate change projected to affect Mali? I mean, you already mentioned that there are subnational differences regarding climate impacts, but what would you say define the way or the ways, to be more exact, in which climate change affects these dynamics you just explained?
I'll start by talking about what the current situation is and then talk about what the projections look like. So in Mali already, we've seen average annual temperatures increase between 1960 and 2015 by 1.2 degrees Celsius. And trajectories show that temperatures in the region are likely to increase, another increase from between 1.2 to 3.6 degrees Celsius by 2060. So you can see that's quite a stark rise in addition to the rise that we already have. When we come to rainfall and extreme weather events, we already see significant interannual and decadal rainfall variability, which means that Mali regularly experiences droughts and floods, sometimes within the same year, which leads to, you know, a loss of lives, livestock, livelihoods, destruction of buildings, infrastructure, land erosion, reduced biodiversity, degradation of trees, plants and soil, etc. And in the future, I mean, it's a bit difficult to know what's going to happen in terms of amount of rainfall, but we can expect that this variability will increase significantly, and that will lead to more extreme weather events, more frequent and extreme weather events. So droughts, flooding, etc.
Very interesting. So you are often like a mix of general risk, droughts, floods, so things that we see across regions and countries. But is there anything that you would say is particular about how the climate impacts affect the people living in Mali today?
It's important to recognize here that there has been variability in climate, not just in Mali, but globally, you know, for decades and centuries. And people in Mali, as elsewhere, have been able to adapt to these changes. They're very skilled and experienced in doing so. So in terms of livelihood diversification, crop diversification, finding new grazing routes, migration, there are lots of different adaptation and resilience strategies. Unfortunately, what we're seeing now is that the level and speed of climate change is really unprecedented. And it's already affecting livelihoods and people's ability to plan livelihoods. So to plan farming, what crops they'll plant, where they'll plant it, their pastoralist routes, grazing routes, their fishing activities. We also see in general, climate change is undermining food security and nutrition. And it's interacting with conflict in ways that we'll talk about later. And unfortunately, these impacts are already happening, but as I told you, given the projections in terms of temperature and rainfall and extreme weather events, you're likely to see these impacts worsen over time in the future.
Thank you. Now let's look a bit deeper into the particularities of Mali. So in your climate fragility risk brief, which, by the way, for our listeners, you can download in this episode's description, you've identified five pathways through which climate change is linked to fragility in Mali specifically. So the first one is rent-seeking and corrupt behavior, which negatively affects livelihoods, environmental degradation, and conflict. So your research showed that nepotism and corruption, along with the unequal generational and gender distribution of power, have eroded state institutions and reduced the legitimacy and influence of local leaders and justice mechanisms. So this behavior has meant land use conflicts remained unresolved and unadjudicated. Could you please explain to us in more detail how this is connected to climate change?
Yes, thank you for that question. So first of all, environmental degradation and climate variability means that there is less land that is fertile. And because of grievances and conflict, that means less land that is both fertile and secure. So you can see how climate change then can affect conflict in terms of increased contestation over natural resources. But then at the same time, these conflict dynamics, and especially this rent-seeking corrupt behavior that you mentioned, can fuel environmental degradation even further if natural resources are improperly managed. And what we see is that in Mali, because local leaders and state authorities are seen as corrupt, either not adjudicating conflicts in the way that they used to in the past, when the conflict resolution mechanisms were really functioning, or adjudicating in ways that are improper based on who pays or based on what will give them profit. Because of this situation, armed opposition groups that are present can really mobilize these grievances and offer alternatives that communities can pursue if the armed opposition groups are in charge. That is kind of an escape away from this corruption and a better management of natural resources in less corrupt ways.
The second risk you identify in your risk brief finds that conflict-insensitive climate and environmental action increases grievances. What do you mean by that?
Here, I think a really good example is the Forest Service, which was established previously, but really strengthened in the 1980s, influenced by the international agenda around sustainable development, the narrative around fighting desertification. And so what we saw was that even in the aftermath of the IMF and World Bank structural adjustment policies, which cut public spending and service provision and the number of civil servants, in forest management, actually, we saw the numbers of officers in the Forest Service increase whilst the rest of the state was contracting. And we had not only an increased number of agents, but an increased severity of penalties and fines. The Forest Service became almost a quasi-paramilitary organization with uniforms and weaponry. And over time, it became one of the key agencies engaging in extortion, particularly because its agents were allowed to keep a percentage of the fines collected. So you can imagine this is an incentive for fining people. And given that the forest has always been a source of resilience during times of economic uncertainty, this has been particularly difficult on populations. So Forest Service agents have been heavy-handed and predatory. So, for example, taxing, imprisoning, fining women who are collecting firewood. They have been particularly harsh on the Fulani community, who are also accused of causing desertification. And all of this not only hinders people's livelihoods, but also reduces their capacity to adapt and cope with external shocks, and also creates and deepens already existing grievances against the state. And so I think this example of the Forest Service is really very illustrative in showing how militarized conservation efforts can either create new conflict dynamics or interact with pre-existing ones to drive conflict or inflame conflict and violence further.
That is really interesting. What I've already learned today from this interview is that if not designed in conflict-sensitive ways, development policies aimed at making resources available and alleviating climate change impacts can actually create or exacerbate conflict dynamics. Now, moving on to the third pathway. In it, you say that migration is both a resilience strategy and source of tension. Could you please elaborate on this?
Yes, definitely. So migration is a way of life for many communities across Mali. It's also one of the main adaptation and resilience mechanisms to climate change, as I mentioned before. And we've seen seasonal and circular migration happening across the years. So, for example, in the Delta, in rural parts of the Delta, a third of the population migrates every season to urban areas in search of work, sending back remittances to their families, which are crucial for family well-being, but then also family resilience. So this is how migration is really natural. It's been happening for generations and centuries, and it's a source of resilience. However, saying that, as a result of climate change and of conflict, these migration patterns have really changed in recent years. And so whereas usually migration would be circular or seasonal, so you move for certain parts of the year and then you move back, now what we see is a more permanent trend and a more southern trend and a more urban trend. So people are moving and then not going back. And if we see extreme climate events increasing in the future, which is what is predicted, this trend may intensify in the future with more people moving southwards to urban areas and on a permanent basis. This can be worrying because migrants can lead very difficult lives, especially as they settle in informal and more marginal areas. While there was historic acceptance of migrants in the past in many parts of Mali, particularly in the south, this is changing in response to increased and more permanent migration. Also, at the same time, we see gender differences here because women and men don't have the same migration opportunities. So in many communities, women tend to stay behind whilst their male family members migrate. And the women who stay behind experience higher precarity because their incomes continue to be affected by climate shocks, but they don't have the resources required for resilience. And migration, which is one key adaptation strategy, is something that is blocked to them. This is not to say that women don't migrate. They do. And especially in certain communities, the migration of girls, the seasonal migration of girls, is very important and necessary for family survival. But this is not in all communities in Mali. And in communities where the men migrate and the women stay behind, this affects the family, but it also affects society as well, because you have more women heading households, fewer men around, and a transformation of local economies.
With climate change progressing, conflicts over natural resources are likely to increase. So I read in your climate risk brief that climate change and conflict reduce the availability of safe and productive land and water resources. Population growth, migration, and climate change increase pressure on and also competition over natural resources. Related conflicts take place with and between communities with similar livelihood traditions. By the way, for our listeners, this is the fourth pathway linking climate to fragility identified in the risk brief. Chitra, could you give an example how this pathway looks like on the ground?
As I mentioned before, there is a history of mostly harmonious relations and beneficial and interdependent economic arrangements. So it's really important to have that context to know that what is happening now is not inevitable and is not something that has always been there. I think often when we talk about natural resource-based conflicts, there's this idea of, you know, the inevitability of it, and that this conflict has been taking place over time and across generations. It will never change because that's how it is, but that's not the case. What we see now is that natural resource-based conflicts increasingly take place, particularly in central and southern Mali, in areas where you had people live, coexist peacefully, more or less, for generations before that. Although most of the time when we talk about natural resource conflicts, people tend to think about farmers and pastoralists clashing, actually there is significant conflict between people who follow the same livelihoods. So between Fulani and Tuareg pastoralists, for example, or between different farming groups, and there is conflict between people of different livelihood groups. So it's really important to kind of complicate the picture that we have of natural resource conflict and to know that violence is not inevitable. And in fact, we can say that in Mali, as in many other places where you have natural resource conflicts, government policy and practice has played a significant role in conflict dynamics. So since the 1950s in Mali, we've seen successive policies reducing pastoralists' access to land and water and privileging agricultural development, which then, of course, left less land available to pastoralists and almost made conflict between farmers and pastoralists due to destruction of crops more likely, because if the pastoralists have less land, where are they going to go to? And this really shows the need to integrate kind of multiple livelihoods into policy planning. At the same time, in the north, we saw that the droughts of the 70s and 80s really marginalized nomadic pastoralists who were unable to sustain their livelihoods, partly because of this agricultural expansion. And this also shows the need to integrate climate uncertainty and variability and climate trajectories into development planning. A final point that I want to make here is that one of the reasons why we had these peaceful relationships within and between different livelihoods previously was due to the strength of conflict resolution mechanisms. And unfortunately, what we have seen is that these resolution mechanisms or these customary arrangements are increasingly either not working or dysfunctional or unable to cope with the rising numbers of conflicts. And this plays into what one of the factors that I mentioned earlier, which is around the corrupt and biased and ineffective nature of local leadership and state institutions and also conflict management mechanisms.
That is a very complex picture that I think is missing in the common rhetoric around what we generally hear between conflicts between pastoralists, farmers and herders. That is definitely a new aspect there. Finally, in the fifth pathway, you found that climate change and conflict both undermine livelihoods and social cohesion. Could you please explain this in more detail?
Yes, of course. I mean, I've already spoken about the impact of climate change on livelihoods. I think we also know that conflict has an impact on livelihoods. And so we can imagine that there is a cumulative impact of these two factors together. And what that really means is that sometimes adaptation mechanisms that people had to climate change are not possible due to conflict, or vice versa. It also means that the combination of the two erodes pathways to resilience. At the same time, we see that conflict, for example, over access to natural resources and related to migration, two factors that we mentioned before, in a context of climate change, reduces levels of social cohesion. So it can make inter-ethnic polarization more apparent. It can also push communities into defense mechanisms where they see the other as an enemy and see an existential threat to their community, which can get them to react and act and create these self-defense militias that I mentioned earlier, which then kind of increases the conflict dynamics and the tensions.
And would you say that these risks affect everyone in Mali equally? That's more of a rhetorical question based on what you've explained up until now.
No, they don't. And as with everything, these risks affect those already marginalized the most, because they are less likely to have access to resources, access to social networks, less likely to engage in adaptation than those who are more part of dominant power structures. And in Mali, we can really say that those who are most affected by climate security are young men, women and girls of all ages, those already impoverished, and those with lesser amount of power and resources.
Personally, I'm very interested in the topic of gender and security. Do you perceive the aspect of gender as an important element in conflict analysis, and how does this play out in Mali?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and we know that climate change affects people of different genders in different ways, that conflict does as well. And so it makes sense that climate security has very gender differential impacts. And we spoke about migration already. It's really important to recognize that even though gender norms place men as heads of households and breadwinners for the family, women actually make significant economic contributions to the households, not just in terms of income generation, but also household labor and childcare as well. But then at the same time, even though they make up 75% of the agricultural workforce, women rarely own the land on which they work. They're constantly denied access to land and the ability to farm safely. In many times, family land is held by the head of household, who tends to be the male elder of the household. There's this idea that women don't need to own land, that more fertile family land is allocated to male relatives, and really seeing women's economic activity in general as secondary to that of men. And so you can really see how these gendered ideas prevent women from having equitable participation in terms of land ownership and use, when it comes to access to markets, accumulating assets and building social networks. And all of these factors are really crucial to resilience, to conflict, to climate change and the intersection of the two. That's when it comes to farming. Now, when it comes to pastoralism, usually men are responsible for managing herds and migration of herds, while women process and sell milk and dairy products. But at the same time, what we have seen is a change in movement patterns in pastoralists, with women tending to stay settled in one community together with the elders, while the young men of the families continue to migrate and graze cattle. And this really places significant stress on these young men. And this is very kind of under-examined and under-researched. And there are very few if any, interventions put in place to support these pastoralist families, to both support these young men, to deal with the gender issues of the women left behind, and to adapt to these changed realities.
Thanks so much for explaining this. In your opinion, how could researchers ensure to include gender dimensions into their conflict and climate analysis and vice versa?
Well, I'll start off by saying that I find that, unfortunately, many researchers or many research studies do not adequately integrate gender into climate security. It's a bit bizarre for me, given that integrating gender into conflict analysis and peacebuilding program, we see so much improvement compared to the situation 10 or 20 years ago. But when it comes to the climate security field, we're still really lagging behind. And yeah, I think that's one area where we really need to improve. I think for me, it's really simple, actually. It's kind of trying to figure out what the gender norms and gender relations are, the way that different factors affect people of different genders differently. Look at if there's any particular impacts that affects one particular subgroup. So for example, as I mentioned around the young pastoralist men, that's really important. It's making sure that you have gender balanced research teams and people engaging in analysis. And it's really taking gender seriously, and taking gender seriously because we should care about gender equitable outcomes, and also taking gender seriously because gender affects conflict dynamics. And if you do not understand gender, you don't understand conflict and you don't understand climate security.
I couldn't agree more. Thank you so much. We've now addressed climate fragility risks in the region, and I'm curious to learn more about entry points to address them. You recommend a number of entry points that the Mali government and other governmental, organizational and multilateral actors should consider when responding to the evolving risks we just heard about. In your opinion, Chitra, what should, or better yet, what can the different actors do to address and avert climate fragility risks in Mali?
So the risk brief talks about five entry points. The first is really responding to the lack of evidence around climate security. So even though this is a growing field of research, we still need better analysis. So the first recommendation or entry point is really conducting integrated climate security assessments to build understanding of climate change and conflict across the whole country, but also being very regionally and context specific in that. The second is responding to some of what we discussed in terms of the role of the state and building the inclusiveness, accountability, and responsiveness of state institutions, including defense and security forces. The third continues our conversation around gender and other forms of marginalization and discrimination. And really, there's a need here to reduce gender and other inequalities amongst populations vulnerable to climate change, to both ensure equity but also mitigate conflict risk. The fourth goes back to the conversation that we had right at the beginning of our discussion around the differences in the region and the risk of an uptick in violence in southern Mali. So engaging in peacebuilding interventions and building climate security resilience in the south. And the fifth is more institutional, and it looks at the UN and ways to build climate security into the UN's mandate in Mali.
Chitra, thank you so much. I'm sure our listeners have a lot of food for thought about the compounding fragilities affecting Mali and the broader Sahel region as well. But let's summarize what we've heard today. Chitra explained that climate change and conflict in Mali further compound each other and impact communities in a self-reinforcing feedback loop. Other factors such as the high poverty rate, slow economic development, dependence on rain-fed agriculture, and environmental degradation exacerbate the climate-related security risks. Influencing factors also include unequal gender power relations, intra- and intergroup inequality, reduced social cohesion, a history of violence, weak governance, an ineffective and unjust conflict, and natural resource management. That's a long list indeed. Those with resources and power can better respond, adapt, and prepare for future climate events and variability. Yet inequality within households and communities, between communities and across the nation, means resources are unevenly distributed. Gender inequalities in particular reduce the resilience of women and girls.
Given the climate variability predicted for Mali, the emphasis needs to be on policies and programs that address climate security risks in a way that work for the future as well as the present. Chitra identified five opportunities for action. First, conducting an integrated climate security assessment to build understanding of climate change and conflict dynamics in the whole country and how they vary between regions. Second, building inclusiveness, accountability, and responsiveness of state institutions, including the defense and security forces, particularly in northern and central Mali. Third, reducing gender and other inequalities among populations vulnerable to climate change to ensure equity and mitigate conflict risk. Fourth, building climate security resilience in southern Mali to mitigate the spread of violence. Fifth, building climate security more thoroughly into the UN's mandate in Mali for increased effectiveness. Thank you to our expert Chitra Nagarayan for giving us her diverse insights on climate fragility risks in Mali. It was a great pleasure having you with us today. Personally, I found the strong gender dimensions to be very interesting. We will be back with another episode of the Climate Diplomacy Podcast in a few weeks. You can reach us with questions and feedback on Twitter at Climate Diplo. Thank you for tuning in, and until next time, goodbye.
Thank you, you too.
And see you soon.
We'll be in touch.
Bye-bye.
Bye.